The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's a brand new week, Monday the 24th of April. It's just 5.5 minutes past nine and you're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show. How are you keeping? How was the weekend? What do you want to talk about? The lines are open for you right now. 086 60 25,000, that's the WhatsApps and texts. You can give us a call too on 07491 25,000, and your emails come into us at comments@highlandradio.com. And if you want to watch the show, go onto our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, or across our Facebook pages, and you can interact with us there. Plenty coming up on the show, actually. A couple of really interesting interviews, I think. In the not too distant future, in fact, Sean Murphy, the general manager at Letterkenny University Hospital, will be on the programme to talk to us about what the situation is down at that hospital in terms of mask wearing. You'll know the HSC has lifted the mandate, but it's down to each individual hospital to make up their own minds. So we'll get an update from him in that regard and a few other items as well. That and so much more besides. But let's look at the front of the Derry People Donegal News this morning. While many of us have been enjoying the glorious weather this week, farmers across Donegal have been putting in Trojan work in a bid to play catch-up following the wettest March on record. With downpours continuing into the first weeks of April, the difficult weather conditions have had a massive impact on farmers. Speaking to the Donegal News, John Meehan, a farmer from Manor Cunningham, said because March was so wet, it has caused great hardship for many farmers. Fields were that wet, it was impossible to get slurry spread to boost early grass growth to get cattle and sheep out of sheds. As a result, additional feed, silage and meal had to be purchased at a cost, he said. John, who lambs his yos from St. Patrick's Day onwards, said this year's wet weather added extra work and extra cost. I was speaking to a couple of farmers at the weekend who were looking for more rain. They said it was very dry at the moment. But I suppose it depends where you are and what kind of farming you were at and when you're yos lamb. I presume there's loads of variables there. The Donegal News tells us that rain campaigners into the west are celebrating yet another record-breaking year for Derry's railway station, which has registered its highest ever passenger numbers. The station also continues to rise up the leaderboard of the north's busiest stations. Figures secured from TransLink for the 12 months to March 2023 saw a phenomenal 723,000 passengers travel to and from Derry by train across that period. That's really quite impressive, isn't it? This represents an increase of more than a quarter of a million passengers compared to the previous year, which was itself also a record year and amounts to a 54% year-on-year rise. 734,000, bar the shouting, passengers using the train out of Derry or into Derry over the last 12 months. The Irish Independent tells us that plans to waive development levies on new houses could reduce the cost of building an average home by more than €21,000. The government is considering temporarily abolishing the levies to encourage developers to build more affordable homes. It's part of a package of measures aimed at kickstarting construction. The levies are charged by local authorities at different rates per square metre to fund infrastructure, including roads, sewage and water. New figures reveal how waiving the fees could reduce the cost of building a 200 square metre home in Dublin by €21,000. It could also knock 9,000 odd euro off the price of building a 75 square metre apartment. Is this seen as good news in this part of the world? Would that encourage, people in Donegal to build a first time home? Or does that make, say, for instance, the likes of the defective concrete block schemes more attractive? I don't know, I'm asking. When you look at it, though, it's a wonder for certain types of builds in this county, considering, or in this country and county, considering that these charges are at the discretion of the council, that they were being charged here at all with everything that's been going on. The Irish Daily Mail, mandatory drug testing of Gardaí should be implemented without delay to maintain confidence in the force, the Fianna Fáil Justice spokesperson has said. In 2015, the Garda Press Office said a testing policy was at an advanced stage, but legislation on the issue has repeatedly been pushed back. TD Jim O'Callaghan told this newspaper it should now be introduced. It's important that drug testing is introduced to preserve confidence in our Gardaí. We have to ensure Gardaí have the full capacity to be able to do this very tough job. The call comes after a couple of remarkable stories coming from an Garda Síochána. It comes after a female Garda who's in her 30s, was arrested on suspicion of possession of cocaine at Dublin Airport on Thursday. A Garda spokesperson said that the misuse of drugs by Garda personnel is not tolerated by the force. And then another interesting story coming out of GSOC, which we'll get to at some point. On to the Irish Times now. Some members of the review group set up to examine the future of the Special Criminal Court are in favour of abolishing the non-jury court, creating a potentially embarrassing situation for the government. The independent review group was established by then Minister for Justice Helen McEntee in February 21 to examine the offences against the state legislation, which is the foundation for the court. The group, which is being led by Mr Justice Michael Pert, a former judge of the Court of Appeal, is made up of six experts from law and academia. It's understood a minority of the group are of the view that the continued operation of the Special Criminal Court is no longer justified. This is based on the much diminished threat from paramilitaries, including dissident groups in recent years. There are just eight subversive prisoners in Port Leisha prison on maximum security, on which houses parliamentary paramilitaries convicted in the Special Criminal Court. So do you have a view on it? Is it something that bothers you? Do you believe we should go back to the situation where everyone is judged by a group of their peers, or do you believe that the Special Criminal Court serves its purpose? 086 60 25000. Over 500 data protection breaches were recorded by the HSE last year, including patients' files going missing or being sent to the wrong people. This is the Irish Daily Star. A log of the data breaches has been released to this newspaper and other under the Freedom of Information. The files show that a medical document was found outside the grounds of Midlands Regional Hospital in Port Leisha. A HSE employee inappropriately accessed the medical data of another staff member in Galway University Hospital last April. Meanwhile, a staff member inadvertently discussed a patient's health data with another patient at Letterkenny University Hospital last December. In the same hospital last May, this is Letterkenny, a list with personal and medical information of patients was found by a service user. I seem to think we might have had contact around that time of someone who said they found that. If my memory serves me correctly. On to the Sun this morning. Boffins have warned that abandoning meat could have catastrophic consequences for Earth. It's very important, I think, that we hear all different sides of various conversations, this being one of them. Richer countries, including Ireland, see a decline in consumption. A new study reveals the trend could backfire. It said slashing meat consumption would harm nutrient security of some of the most vulnerable people in the world. The research published in the Oxford Uni Journal, Animal Frontiers, said unintended economic, social and environmental consequences when abandoning livestock could prove catastrophic. And the report cast doubt over claims that meat alternatives loved by vegans are better. Chagask, the Agriculture and Food Development Authority, yesterday welcomed the study. Spokesperson Declan Troy said livestock farming supports the livelihoods of about one in six people on the planet. It supplies food, nutrition, income and more to hundreds of millions of people and is enduring cultural significance to many. But it's funny, it's quite interesting, and I wouldn't over-amplify it either, but it's tiny. You have to find it in just a short few papers, in a few papers really is what I'm trying to say. But you'd imagine that that kind of information would be of great interest to the general public. Finally, the Irish Daily Mirror this morning. Comedian Patrick Kilty has emerged as the front runner to become the new host of The Late Late Show. The County Down funny man, as is described in the paper here, is seen as a popular choice to replace Ryan Tuberty, who will depart from the RTE-hosted hot seat after 14 years next month. Bookmakers Paddy Power have now slashed their odds on Kilty, 52, replacing Tubbs after some heavy betting on him over recent days. Kilty is now down to odds of just 2-1 to take over the world's longest running chat show, having been out as far as 12-1 just a few days ago. So he is the favourite. Claire Byrne also remains as one of the favourites to take over that role. And just finally on the front of this paper, I thought I picked it out of another one. It's this remarkable story, something that if it was in a TV show, you might think it's a little far-fetched. Well, some of us might, not everyone. But a GSOC investigator who quit... Now, this is someone who works for the Guard. He's a GSOC investigator. He is allegedly, or they, I'm not sure if it's a man or a woman, were at a party with Jerry the Monk Hutch. He's left GSOC now and is about to leave Ireland. A report will be carried out into the incident, but a source said he's not a member anymore and cannot be ordered to talk. It comes as Del Boy Hutch was snapped in Dublin despite being a Kinahan target. And they're picturing all of them in all of the papers today. Just an update on a story we covered last week. It was concerns over the future for residents of Ardgrania in Stranorlar. It was part of a plan called A Time to Move On. Mary T. Sweeney of Aintu was on saying she'd spoken to some family members that were worried about it. Since then, I've heard from others who are waiting to see what is proposed and some that feel that it might be positive, that they've seen it happen elsewhere and it might well work well for their loved ones. But as I say, the jury is out. We got onto the HSC to see what they had to say in it. It's a long-winded statement. But anyway, in 2011, the time to move on from congregated settings, a strategy for community inclusion report was published and adopted as national HSC policy. The report identified that over 4,000 people with disabilities in Ireland were living in congregated type settings, defined as where 10 or more people reside in a single living unit or are campus-based. It's government and HSE priority to ensure that all residents in existing congregated settings are actively supported to move into the community with person-centred support that will enable them to lead the life of their choice and participate as equal citizens in the local community. Residents will be supported to live in their local communities with no more than four people with a disability living together. Community healthcare for this region, disability services, have a communications and engagement strategy in place which sets out how services engage with all relevant people on decongregation. Residents living in congregated settings, their agreed family members or other support persons as well as staff. Residents living in congregated settings are supported through the decongregation process by the multidisciplinary staff team, family members and other support persons so that the necessary wraparound supports will be available to support them as they move to community living. Now, the move to new homes in the community for residents of Ardgrania Court will take place over the coming years. Moves will take place when engagement processes and plans are completed for each individual and new homes are procured and ready for occupancy. Homes will meet the residential standards as regulated by the Health Information Quality Authority. Each resident will be at the centre of the decision-making process for their move. Under decongregation, residents will be supported in all decisions, such as where their new home will be, who they will live with, and the type of house they will live in. Disability services in the locality and multidisciplinary staff teams will ensure people moving to their own homes will receive the support they require to live the life of their choice. Staff have availed of specific training programs as to how best support people moving to and living in the community. So that is the thrust of that statement. The last line reads, the decongregation of Ardgrania Court is at an early stage and engagements will continue ongoing throughout the process. The family engagement sessions held last Tuesday, which were attended by family members of 13 residents, will be followed up with further engagements and communications throughout the decongregation process. Okay, so that's the HSE's view on all of that. Right, okay, now we're joined on the programme by Stephen McGrory, Senior Executive Engineer with Green Waves Projects. Good morning to you, Stephen. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Greg. Thanks very much for having us.
Right, we're in the consultation process, are we now, as it relates to the Bunkrana to Carndonagh Greenway. What are the basic proposals that you're seeking the public's views on?
Yeah, well, we're just really introducing the project to the public. The stage, Greg, we've set out the study area. Kind of runs from Bunkrana to the south to Carndonagh in the north. That's the basis of the route. And it goes way out to the west, or the west through Elise, or to the east through Dunray. And basically, it's a large study area. Within that area, we'll develop a number of routes going forward. But at this stage, we're looking for engagement from the public, anybody who has an interest in the Greenway or the area, the local communities. And we're trying to identify the constraints and the opportunities that exist within the area, which might benefit our Greenway and which our Greenway might benefit the public.
Yeah. So in terms of route, we just have a start and finish at this point, do we? Are there any proposals or?
No. There's a code of practice for developing greenways, and we're very much at the start of that process. And what we're introducing is the area and the project. So it's a blank canvas, really. What we have ruled out is the kind of the high ground, your sleeve snacks, your Melmore gaps and that kind of stuff, because really wouldn't suit a greenway. But at this stage, the route's open, and we'll develop within the study area maybe 5 or 6 different groups and go back to the public for further consultation. Then they can let us know their views on what they would like and where they would like to see it go.
So what does a greenway look like now? I mean, in terms of its width, the surface, is it fenced in? Like, what are the guidelines in terms of constructing a greenway in 2023?
Yeah. Well, very much has changed, you know, and has developed over with a lot of changes in the last year or so. But typically what you expect to see, if it was an urban area, maybe 5 metres wide, or a more rural setting, be 3 metres wide, be a high-quality surface. Segregated from traffic's important. We're looking for something that's safe, sustainable. What the guidelines would be telling us, we're looking for things that are scenic, with lots of things to see and do en route. And, you know, we're tripping over scenery here in Donegal, so we're blessed in that regard. We're looking for something that's sustainable and strategic, so we're looking at links into Northern Ireland and further afield, and links into existing tourist infrastructure. And that's really what we're trying to tease out at this stage.
And I mean, it is a big piece of work because it covers a great deal of distance. And there are great opportunities, don't get me wrong, and it would be hugely popular when concluded, I'm sure. But there's an awful lot of land that has to be gone through, you know, potentially splitting a farmer's land or what have you. That could just be, you know, the first half a kilometre. There are great challenges in getting enough agreement from point A to point B to progress something like this, is there not? I mean, can it actually be achieved?
Yeah, there are challenges involved, but I mean, the code of practice, which is set out and say that we have to engage voluntarily with landowners. And the thing about it is, it's not like it's a road or anything. So we can go around the boundaries of farms and not affect them too much. You know, and in some ways that's a better route. You know, if you're out with the kids, they like to scoot along ahead of you and get around the next corner on you. But yeah, so we're not really tied to straight lines and gentle curves. We can have more twisting and winding route. I mean, that as we develop through the process, we'll develop these options, we'll select the preferred route, and within that we'll fine-tune it down into a more detailed design. And at that stage, we'll be engaging one-on-one on landowners and find out what works for them. And look, we'll have project agronomists on board who will be available to the landowners at that stage to discuss how it might affect their lands and advise us how we can minimise the impact on the landowners. The whole ethos of the Code of Practice now is to reach voluntary agreement with landowners.
There are no provisions for CPOs or anything in this type of a project. It's all done through, you know, voluntary engagement and through agreement.
No, there's also CPO process within it, but that very much runs in the background. And really, it envisages that it'll tie up things like, you know, there where you would have land plots where there's maybe the title isn't fully resolved or things like that. But it'll enable the process. But the ethos of the Code of Practice and what we've been trying to do very much reach things by agreement with landowners and not impose our will upon them.
And in terms of, say, for instance, if I had a bit of land on this route, am I compensated for that? And, you know, say, for instance, I have livestock on one side of the fence and the fence is damaged. Who's responsible for that? I know that it might not seem a big deal, but for others, it might. So, in other words, are landowners compensated for the use of their land, and are they indemnified to some extent in terms of the maintenance of the fence, or if someone hops over the fence, or what's the story?
Oh, for sure. Like, as part of the process, we'll be tying all these things down with landowners. So in terms of the purchase of the land and dealing with their livestock and that kind of stuff, we will agree accommodation works. So there may be a fence on our side that keeps keeps the cyclists in and away from their livestock. And there may very well be a fence on the farmer's side, which will deal with, keeping their livestock within their own fields. In terms of land purchase, you know, the farmers do get compensated, A, for the price of the land, B, for, injurious infection, and if they happen to separate a field, you know, there's a payment for that as well. On top of that, and on top of any agreed fees for the landowners, for greenways over 20 kilometres in length, such as this, there's the greenway sustainability payment, which is paid there it's paid in two parts. The first part is paid when the voluntary agreement is paid, or the voluntary agreement is signed, but prior to planning, and the second part then is on the completion of the greenway.
All right. Now, I mean, obviously, some of this is how long's a piece of string, but realistically, how long might it take to deliver a project like this, a Boncrana to Carn on a greenway?
Yeah. Again, to a certain extent, we're at the hands of third parties here. We would be intending to coming back now with the routes, the various routes by the end of the year, and having a further public consultation towards this time next year, the middle of next year. We'll be coming back then with a preferred route corridor and have more meaningful engagement. And within that, then we'll start developing the preliminary design that we'll be bringing forward to planning. As part of that, there may or may not be a need for an environmental impact assessment, but there'll be some form of planning in place. And based on that, then, what the Code of Practice tells you, we must then consult with landowners for a period of a year before we can advertise our planning permission, and then for a further year afterwards. Now, within that period, we'll be developing our detailed design. So within 4 to 5 years, we could be, you know, with a fair wind, and if everything goes well with more Planala, we could be looking at starting construction.
All right. Well, every journey starts with the first step, and this is, well, it's not really the first step. I know you are already doing quite a bit of work on it, but in terms of the public consultation, it feels the first one. It feels like a significant step forward. There are two in-person public consultation events coming up, one in Boncrana, one in Carndonagh. What are the details of those, Stephen?
Yes, we're in Boncrana tomorrow and the Inishowen Gateway Hotel from 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock. Every member of the public is very, very welcome to attend. And likewise, we're in Carndonagh Public Service Centre from 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock on Wednesday. Now, for those people that can't make it to the in-person events, we'll also be putting up public displays for a period of 2 weeks afterwards. The first one in the Boncrana Library, and the second one in Carndonagh Public Service Centre. And we also have a project website which went live on Friday there, which is Boncrana to Carndonaghgreenway.ie. And people can see on there all the information that's going out in the public consultations, and they're invited to make their submissions and their feedback on that website.
Okay, thank you for that, Stephen. Take care of yourself. That's Stephen McGrory there, who's Senior Executive Engineer with Greenways Projects. Fingers crossed. I feel like I've been talking about greenways for quite some time, and it'd be nice to see some delivery of that. It's not the fault of Stephen and his team. It's just sometimes wheels move slowly, don't they? Hi, Greg. In early February, my sister posted a large Jiffy envelope to us here outside Boncrana. She went to her local post office in Kent, which is in England, paid postage, completed customs forms to indicate contents and cost due to Brexit. It was a few birthday cards, anniversary cards, etc. The package never arrived. She did the similar cards of early March, same story, post office, custom forms, etc. This package has yet to be received. She's out of pocket at present for the sum of £12 sterling. Post office blames Ireland. Has any of your listeners got the same problem? We'd be glad of any help that comes in from Mary. So it seems, in this case at least, the simple act of sending a Jiffy bag with some cards in it, it hasn't been successful twice. And of course, they're at £12, but also the effort of going to the post office and doing the custom forms and what have you. Any experience of that? Do you know what's going on there? What has gone wrong? 086 60 25,000. 086 60 25,000. Right, okay, some comments carried over from last week. Hi, Greg, just to say it's great to see the dog warden out checking those unlicensed dogs in our community. It might help promote responsible ownership. Okay, didn't know about that. The Happy Pair twins have apologised for comments made by an American doctor on their podcast, which claimed a link exists between taking antibiotics and depression. I was on antibiotics for 8 months and I, for one, listened to it and yesterday thought, thank God, because as someone who didn't have depression, I did find it rising in myself. I don't know. I'm familiar. I haven't really heard any of the Happy Pair podcasts. They're not for everyone, I would imagine. They have a slight problem in that they present themselves as one thing, but if you then take on doctors issuing medical advice, it can be somewhat problematic. I'm not sure what the general medical consensus is as it relates to a link between antibiotics and depression, but I suppose some might say that if you were sick enough to be on antibiotics for 8 months, that maybe it could be the underlying issue that was a problem. I don't know. As I say, I generally think you have to be careful when just taking on a podcast like that there. But that being said, I don't see any problem with them, but they seem to get an awful lot of abuse online and a lot of people reveling in the fact that they got something wrong, or they say they claim they got something wrong, which I don't see. I don't get no pleasure in that either. Sean Murphy is the general manager of Letterkenny University Hospital. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Greg. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you for joining us. Okay. So just as it relates to mask wearing in the hospital, what came out from the HSE last week and what impact is it going to have on Letterkenny University Hospital in terms of what it chooses to do?
Okay. So I suppose in summary, what came out from the HSE was guidance that surgical or respirator masks were no longer required to be mandatory in all healthcare settings. But they also highlighted the fact that risk assessments should be undertaken in individual hospitals or in individual healthcare settings to reflect the prevalence of COVID and the risks associated with COVID transmission. And also that hospitals should all healthcare settings. Mm-hmm. Should undertake risk assessments and be cognizant of the use of masks with appropriate patients, mainly those with severe viral tract infections or respiratory tract infections.
So what is going to change at Letterkenny University Hospital going forward then? Because I imagine your staff, if your staff would have worn masks long before COVID when appropriate in any case.
They absolutely would have. You're right. So our infection control guidance highlights a number of areas where masks are required to be worn. Obviously, with COVID, and you may recall, we were one of the first hospitals that in the country that actually said to staff, for all patient interactions, wear a mask, because at that stage we had lots of undiagnosed COVID and then it became mandatory in all healthcare settings. What changed as of Wednesday is we've taken the decision now that masks are not required to be worn on in non-clinical areas. So the corridors, meeting rooms, the foyer, etc., we are not requiring either members of the public nor staff to wear masks. However, we are also conscious some individuals may choose to wear masks. They may feel it more appropriate. They may feel more safer wearing the masks. We will make the masks available for those who choose to wear the masks, but it's not required. Mm-hmm. With regard to clinical areas, we are continuing to do our risk assessments. Again, I see that situation will change over the coming weeks, if not days. Some of the low-risk clinical areas, I think we will remove the need to wear masks. But there will be some areas where, again, and as you said, there were always certain areas in certain circumstances where masks were worn, be they surgical masks or respirator masks. And that will continue.
Okay, what is the feedback from go ahead, Sean.
Sorry.
Finish your point.
Yeah. I was going to say, what we're trying to do with the clinical areas is make sure that people aren't confused when they come into the hospital. It's quite clear if it's a non-clinical area, you don't have to wear a mask. But we need to be absolutely clear with members of the public and our own staff that that when, you know, which areas you are required to wear a mask entering and which you're not.
Okay, so if we're all being very open and frank, then I might as well ask a question that I'm not sure of the answer to, so maybe other people out there. What is the difference between clinical and non-clinical then? I mean, okay, how do you define that in layman's terms?
Where admitted patients or patients are undergoing assessments or treatments or have been admitted or resident in. So the clinical areas where we are continuing to wear masks at this point are the emergency department, the outpatients department, the wards, etc. Whereas the general areas like the foyer, the corridors, etc., we're not requiring masks.
Right, so, I mean, obviously, I think the majority of the public are kind of over it, if you know what I mean, whether that's right or wrong, but I think that seems to be the case. So some of the strongest commentary I'm hearing at the moment is coming from unions. Some unions feel that this is a little bit premature. What is the feeling amongst staff that you've polled in the hospital? Are they opposed to this? Are they in favour of it?
Well, I suppose I haven't polled the staff, so I couldn't say anything based on any sort of pseudo statistical basis. What I can tell you is, you know, from general discussions and observing, as I said, quite a number of staff have chosen to continue wearing masks in the public areas or in the non-clinical areas. And I also know many staff were happy to be able to not have to wear the masks in those areas. So it is quite mixed. And I suppose what always strikes me, if you go, when we come out of work and you go into the shops, there's still a mixture of those that choose to wear masks and those that don't, because they're no longer required to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose at the end of the day, the hospital staff are of the community and they're going to be representative of that in different points of views,
absolutely,
and different attitudes, aren't they? I mean, they're not different.
You're absolutely right, Greg. One thing I would say, however, and I think it's important, is that people are particularly conscious of not visiting the hospital, particularly visiting. Obviously, if you need healthcare attention, you need to come to the hospital. But people coming in to visit, if you've got respiratory symptoms, if you're unwell, please do not come to the hospital, because we would have said this before when you and I would have spoken before COVID, when there were influenza seasons, etc. I mean, it's just good common practice. If you are at risk of having a transmissible or a viral infection, coming to the hospital puts the staff and other patients at risk, and particularly patients where they are their immune systems are already weakened, they're already vulnerable. If you are coming from clinical or medical attention, obviously that is more important than the fact that you may have a viral infection. But in that case, again, wear a mask and make it known to staff that you are symptomatic, so that we can take appropriate precautions.
All right. Just really while I have you.
Good infection.
Yeah. As you say, we would have had that conversation long before anyone ever heard of the COVID pandemic.
I think what changed with COVID is suddenly people started to take much more serious, and we don't want to lose the fact that viral infections can be very problematic and make people very ill, particularly those that are most vulnerable.
Reports today of 500 data breaches recorded by the HSC, two at your hospital. One, a staff member inadvertently discussed a patient's health data with another patient at the hospital, and another, a list with personal and medical information of patients was found by a service user. Your reaction to that, Sean?
Obviously, very disappointing. I apologise to all patients that were affected. We worked very hard to highlight the importance of confidentiality and the importance of keeping documentation that identifies patients absolutely secure. It starts with staff on induction and is reiterated through departmental meetings and our quality meetings, etc. in terms of the first example, I mean, I'm not making excuses, but it is difficult sometimes where you have people of the patients of the same name and surname, and you'd be surprised it happens quite frequently, and living in the same townland, and occasionally even in the same street. Again, we do have a system in place to alert staff that if there's two patients with the same name or very similar names on a ward, to highlight the staff so that they check with, because each patient has a unique patient number, they should check that they are speaking with the right patient. Similarly, we've taken a number of measures over the last number of years, including putting shredding bins that are locked and with a letterbox type. From lists and patient lists as they're going around and undertaking treatments and organising tests. But for those documents to be put in those bins to be shredded so that they're not left lying around. I think in the case that you're talking about was found in the hospital in a patient room, it may well have fallen out of somebody's pocket and they didn't notice. I'm not saying that's acceptable, but as I say, we will continue to try and take every measure that we can to ensure the security of patient information.
All right, just a couple of quick ones. Just as it relates to the emergency department now, are attendees separated now based on COVID-like symptoms or not going forward?
We are still separating, and that's why I said if you are coming into the hospital and need of medical attention, please wear a mask and alert the staff. So what we want to do is ensure that we minimise the risk of spreading any infection, but particularly COVID we're talking about today.
A couple of callers asking, is there a problem with sepsis in the hospital at the moment, an unusual amount of cases?
I suppose there's always issues in terms of the sepsis. I'm not aware of any particular unusual amount, but we have seen increases in numbers of cases of sepsis. And I think that's something that is not unique to Letterkenny. It's across all hospitals. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see it becoming more and more problematic because so many infections are becoming antimicrobial resistant. Again, you know, there's a lot of education with our clinical staff in the hospital, but across the whole healthcare system about appropriate use of antibiotics, because unfortunately, life is wonderfully resilient, and organisms and infections can actually adapt and develop significant antibiotic resistance, and that increases the risk of sepsis. Because the patients are not responding to the antibiotic treatments that should control those infections.
All right, and finally, in the minute that we have, how is recruitment going at the hospital? I had a very brief look at a report which I think suggested that in Galway there are issues with recruitment because of a lack of available accommodation. How is recruitment going for the vacant posts at Letterkenny University Hospital, and is the housing crisis impacting on that process?
Recruitment is going very well generally, and I might just come back to elaborate that in a moment. The housing crisis it's not something that has featured significantly in terms of my experience for recruitment. I think it's still possible to get accommodation in Letterkenny. It becomes more problematic where we have seen it is where people are coming to take fixed-term posts maybe for 6 or 12 months because they're covering somebody's leave or absence. Again, the pressure on rental accommodation in particularly in the Letterkenny area is quite significant. And we've seen that as being a challenge. As I say, one of the strengths of Letterkenny, we do very well in terms of recruiting people with from Donegal or Donegal connections that may have gone abroad, and often they have family connections, so maybe the accommodation is less of an issue than you would have if you were in Dublin, etc. But even for other staff that don't have Donegal connections, they've been able to find accommodation, or we've been able to support them in finding accommodation. But when I say recruitment is going well, there are particular areas of challenge because, and we would have talked about this before, there is a wide variety of types of staff, health and social care professionals, so your therapists, your nursing staff, and even nursing, you know, theatre nurses versus general nurse and general ward nurses, staff with critical care experience, etc., and medical staff. So we have a number of specialties where we still struggle because it's an international issue that there are limited numbers of people in areas such as radiology, in Ireland, geriatric medicine. So there are particular hotspots that we are constantly challenged in recruiting to.
Okay, listen, thanks for all of your time this morning. I appreciate it. That's Sean Murphy there, the General Manager of Letterkenny University Hospital. Brendan O'Connor is President of the Garda Representative Association, joins us now. Good morning to you, Brendan. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
It's good to have you with us. Firstly, what is your reaction to this news that a senior member of a GSOC, a senior investigator, has had to resign following allegations that he told colleagues, remarkably, that he attended a party with Gerard Hutch? There's talk now that this member might leave the country. What's your reaction to that news?
Well, just, Greg, I would just clarify that I won't be drawing in comments on the individual circumstances of what has occurred, but it certainly, it brings the conversation back to where the GRA have always had, and there's a serious question marks about GSOC and about how, it's more about the oversight mechanisms, and unfortunately in Donegal here, it resonates with us. We had the tragic death of our colleague Sergeant Michael Gavin, and there were serious questions then, and what happened then was, again, it's completely different circumstances, but there was questions about the conduct of GSOC, and there was no proper oversight mechanism, and it took ministerial intervention to set up an inquiry. So that's why we see this service, GSOC, we absolutely embrace independent oversight and investigation of our members, but with that responsibility comes a certain an obligation to be as transparent as the people you're investigating, and it's simply not there for GSOC. So yet again, we see another issue arising with GSOC, and everyone is looking to say, what should we do? How will we deal with this? And that's just not acceptable, especially with a body who's, there's currently legislation before the Oireachtas that's going to give GSOC even more power. So we have that checks and balances.
What would you like to see then? How do we perhaps, I mean, I'm not conflating the two issues, but we've got this story focusing on GSOC at the moment, and we've spoken in the past as it relates to rank and file concerns. So whilst we're in a review process, what needs to change then?
Well, we need just a clear protocol, a complaints process, because a lot of time our members, sorry, not a lot of time, sometimes they have issues with how GSOC conduct themselves, and there's no, we would see no transparency and accountability. So I won't give a prescriptive description of exactly what we want, but we want a protocol in place that's transparent, that's open, that everybody knows what levels of accountability apply, because with power and with responsibility comes accountability. Those are very basic principles of any criminal aspect of the criminal justice system. We see them for our members, but it comes back to who watches the watchers. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but that is the issue. Mm. Do I have the prescriptive description of exactly what's needed? No. But again, GSOC hold our members to a very high standard, and rightly so. So they should be held to equally high standards. And we don't know how to have confidence in the system whenever there is no protocols in place.
All right. Despite some suggestions from some high-profile people, being a member of the Garda is a dangerous activity with a large number of assaults, varying in severity, of course. Is it still the GRA's position that the use of tasers, or having access to tasers, carrying tasers, would help to perhaps see off some of these rising assault figures on members?
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. And, you know, we look at Donegal there and we see members working in locations on their own, and we rely on, they're very vulnerable, they're isolated, there's very little backup. So tasers, if we look to Scotland as we're a comparable jurisdiction, and officers operating in the Highlands carry tasers. So we're looking for more tasers. Not every guard have a taser, but if a guard in Inishowen needs someone to come to their assistance out in Mallon, that someone in Buncrana would have it. Similarly, someone out in Lifford could call on someone in Letterkenny. So just more tasers. We believe it's an incremental response to the levels of violence our members are being subjected to in these assaults. So it's used in other jurisdictions without any major concerns, and we believe it's entirely appropriate that we would have that escalation available to non-lethal force. Normally, now we have, usually we have a step from baton and handcuffs to firearm and nothing in between. So we need to have more availability. And it's in the interest of offenders too. People can be neutralized before they even harm themselves. Sometimes people who have suicidal ideations, the taser can disable them, and the guards can get close to someone with a knife when they wouldn't be able to intervene.
Where's the resistance coming from? We've been talking about this for quite some time. It still hasn't happened yet. Where's the resistance coming from?
Well, look, we would be always very kind of cynical, Jerry. We'd expect it's costs. Maybe there is ethical issues. That it's a step towards arming the Gardaí. We have a very proud tradition of being an unarmed service. People would see the more use of force, the more access to weapons to Gardaí, that it compromises our relationship with the public. Maybe it would make guards a little bit more intimidating. We wouldn't agree with that, but maybe that's the issue. But certainly there is a huge cost implication and a training implication. And also we don't have the really go hand in hand with body cams in other jurisdictions, because again, that transparency that we embrace, you have to have a body cam so the public and the people who are subject can have confidence that the decision making used by the officer was correct. So it's part of, look, we're just 30 years behind most jurisdictions in relation to our equipment and our training, and we would see that as probably an impediment.
Now, a lot of guards are leaving the force. Obviously, some will retire, others are resigning, just taking up different careers. I think the Garda Commissioners of the opinion that when you compare us to other countries, which we often do, we've been doing it in this conversation, that the attrition rate's relatively low. Do you share his views in that, or would you be making a counterpoint to that?
No, we don't share the Garda Commissioners' view. I mean, what is happening now is a phenomenon. It may be reflected in our jurisdictions, but Garda Síochána was always a career for life. People are very, I wouldn't say happy. I think everyone finds their own work, but it workplace challenging. But we had conditions and a status and a job satisfaction that made people stay for life, and a lot of people exceeded their 30-year service. But all the indicators are that people are not happy. They're choosing to leave, whether through retirement or resignation, and we think that's indicative of a very low morale and a level of discontent among the force. And we believe there is a disconnect. And I think we believe that it's nearly a denial of Garda management, because they're not even acknowledging or addressing the issue. The GRA have taken the issue. We're having our exit interviews. We're doing the research that Garda management have been shamed into doing to copy us. So we certainly believe there's a piece of work there for Garda management to address the issue.
All right. Thanks for your time this morning. I do appreciate it. Take care of yourself. That is Garda Brendan O'Connor, president of the Garda Representative Association. Their 45th annual delegation conference takes place in Mayo, I believe, this week. So you get an idea of some of the topics that will be up for discussion there.